Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, it feels a little ironic to say good morning when we've been up for like 7 hours or something. A bit more for Daniel than that. But yeah, still morning. Apparently, that's what we call it anyway. Use this, these schemes of labels and names and ways in which we navigate this experience. I wanted to thank those who have given the talk so far in the last couple of days that I've enjoyed. Certainly an encouragement during session to hear words or have reminders and pointers. It can be that. It's difficult to sit so much for these long periods of time. Although I'm impressed with everybody, because even at the beginning of Dharma talk with the opportunity to stand, everybody just still sits on the ground before the talk. Just haven't had enough sitting, so well done. I wanted to bring up a koan from our tradition. It's just occurred to me what to talk about, and a good place to really perhaps to look for inspiration is something that's currently in one's own mind, in your own experience, something that feels relevant. And then I even went to the trouble of, just before I came up, I jotted down some notes, which I didn't want to forget, and then I forgot my notes, so see how that goes. But this is a case from the Mumonkon, of the Gateless Gate. Even that title really sums up somewhat the subtlety of the difficulty of the Zen school. Right there, the apparent contradiction, right there where words don't successfully explain in a meaningful way. You know, a gateless gate. And from our collection here, this one is case 45, who is that one? The case. Ancestor N of Tozan said, even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. Just tell me, who is that one? Mumon's commentary. If you clearly recognize that one, it will be just like meeting your father at the crossroads. It is not necessary to ask others whether it is he or not. In the verse, don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't speak of another's faults. Don't try to know about another's affairs. So again, with the main case, Ancestor N of Tozan said, even Shakyamuni and Maitreya as servants of that one. Just tell me, who is that one? Even Shakyamuni and Maitreya as servants of that one. Just tell me, who is that one? So in our tradition, you know, and represented here on the altar in the Buddha Hall, is a great exemplar of the lineage is Shakyamuni Buddha, who's we look to as the founder. Although in the lineage that you've been chanting in the mornings, yeah, it's been make the important note there that before the Buddha, there were other people, there were other founders. You know, in the lineage, I think it lists six before the Buddha. Might be one off there. But that doesn't really matter. That lineage could go back as far as it has come from the Buddha. But we use him as a great example and a starting point, and an unusual and inspiring example in the sense of he did something really unprecedented. You know, I laughed out loud with Mokko and, you know, with his comment on life is suffering, you know, which I found a good comment, that life was brutal and short. are full of suffering. So it's that has not left us now, but we do have a certain advantages that have come, of course, with a more advanced civilization. Other things which are difficulties, but a lot of advantages. Enough for us to say, well, I don't know if it's suffering. And maybe back then that was more felt, more a little more obvious, with people, you know, dying in the street left and right. That's a little more hidden now, even. But where he was different, Shakyamuni Buddha, was being born into a high caste and high status, power protected position of the day. And of course, it must take someone of great drive and great capacity to give up a life of apparent ease or protection, to give that up, particularly in those circumstances of the day. But for him, the drive to confront and to come to understand, to illumine the great matter of this experience, the experience of life and death, the experience of impermanence, that was urgent enough for him to leave behind a life of apparent ease. And that is, you know, throughout history, that's a very rare case. See, you know, if you start with nothing, it's easier to go looking for something. So we put him at the beginning here, even Shakyamuni Buddha. And Maitreya is for Buddha to come at the end. It's all in this great distant future. The Buddha who comes right at the end and wraps up the whole show. And I remember reading when I was beginning to study Buddhism that Maitreya had said in some text that I read that he's going to show up, or he, she, is going to show up in 5.5, something like 5 billion years from now. So I thought, well, that's it. But then I found that somewhat interesting, because I read at the time what got me into Zen practice was the gate of coming in through reading about cosmology and quantum mechanics, and really looking to try and find meaning or understanding in this mysterious experience, finding out what it means. And I read somewhere with the sun's life, it's about halfway through right now. And we're about halfway through life, and it's about five. It's got about 5 billion years to go. So maybe Maitreya's going to come just when the sun becomes a red giant. Yeah, it kind of lines up ballpark anyway. Doesn't really matter. What's important is in this setup that the teacher is using, even the Shakyamuni Buddha, right from the beginning, even that one right from the beginning, if we use him as beginning point, to that one which we're going to use as the end point, and everyone and everything in between is the servant of that one. And then he asks, who is that one? You know, certainly when I came into beginning practice, I didn't really have a lot of feeling about doing it for others, you know, or concern for others particularly, beyond your, you know, I wasn't a sociopath, hopefully, but it's like most of my concern was with myself and my own mission, my own search for meaning. That's how I came into this. You know, I remember I would read these increasingly complex books, scientific books, and I could keep up for a good chunk of it. But I sort of reached my limit of what I could hold between my ears. And I came across Zen, which immediately I saw was consistent with these principles. Sorry, there's something there that felt like, that I knew was truth. There was some truth there. And I remember my grandfather, who's a real positive influence on my life, he was a great reader. You know, library was very important in my little rundown working class town in Wales. The library was about the best you know, was the best thing about the town, really. I should remember that this has been recorded. There were other good things too, but the library was a great one, and I managed to get some books on Zen. And I always remember he came in and he saw what I'd got, and then and he said, "You know what, David? You should stop right here. You know, that's enough." and I chose to, and I ignored that advice, for good or for ill. You know, for me it was more important. It was however he meant that. I'm sure he meant that well. You know, it's like too much inquiry along these lines. Just get on with your life. You know, and there were consequences in what I did for myself. You know, I was involved. I had a long relationship. I owned a house, I had family, and I ditched everything. And that hurt people in my quest to become enlightened. Very selfish goal, really. But it was something, or it could be, you know, but it was something that I felt like I needed to do. Everyone, all those who come to Sesshin have way-seeking mind. Everybody decided not to go on something, do something else for a week, but rather to come here. There is that drive to really look and to make this great matter, this mysterious life, to make this, to find freedom, to find peace, whatever your own drive is. Shakyamuni's was Shakyamuni's. You know, we say that this one here is the Buddha. You know, we're encouraged to realize that, but there's also great difference alongside that intrinsic unity, where you appear as this, I appear as this. And there's also great difference. But every one of us is here, in this place. And it really is a great mystery and an extraordinary thing. And there's still a great yearning in human beings, in many of us, to really come to grips with it, to come to grips with this life. For many years, human life was just the same, pretty much. As in, not a lot changed. I really like that. I saw in a documentary about the caves of Chauvet in France, back in the Neolithic, where they have these amazing paintings. And they have these handprints that people left on the wall. They're beautiful, they're haunting to me. You know, I'm sure to many people. These handprints, like, I was here. You know, each one of us has got that handprint up on the wall right now. I'm here. And there's handprints there which were so many, you know, 20,000 years old now. And then there's another handprint to the side. And somebody did the same thing 5,000 years later. And in that period then, in that place, probably not much changed for 5,000 years. So just the life, living and dying, having children, being torn apart by animals, you know. Or all those things, good highs and lows, a lot that's the same as now, but not a lot of change. Of course, now we're living in this time where, like, our change feels more and more rapid. You know, I heard this a while, you know, like the new iPhone's coming out. The one I have is fine. I, you know, my son likes to tease me. He goes, "Oh, you love that phone." You know, and I do in one sense, you know. And it's just like, yeah, it's a cool thing, isn't it? Now there's a new one. Not sure we really need a new one every year. But there's that sense of things, we're really going at a clip. On the level of things, on the level of form, and becoming more global, more connected, You know, we've got access to more problems if we want to look for them. Instant access to a world of problems. But then we come to this zazen. We come to practice. You know, we take the radical step and we make the radical shift that turns the light to the basis of life, and we look at that which doesn't change. We look at that which is always the same. That which unites everyone and everything from Shakyamuni to Maitreya and everything in between. You know, often we're so concerned with the changing content. We're really always plugged in that way. And if we don't have a device, then we're plugged into the device in our heads, which is also just like churning data, churning the content. And we easily become attached to that, or enamored of that, or so involved in that, that we don't really know how to put that down, or really how to step aside or step out of that. That's when, you know, we say something, look at that which doesn't move. It's, well, that stops the mind dead. What does that mean? But we find that in our practice of thusness, thisness, the immersion in this oneness doing, which I stole from Aishu's teacher, right? But this oneness doing this one thing, this one experience, this one realization, this one, now appearing as some words thrown out and listening and sitting, just this sitting. What is there really to do with that? Where is the meaning? Does there need to be a meaning, both? Is there something that's missing in this experience, which seems to change? It changes in terms of impermanence and changing forms, but something doesn't change. There's this, always. Its appearance is change. This is where we come up against where the intellect, our thinking it through, doesn't reach. Our self-descriptions start to fall apart. Our understandings, attainments or beliefs and opinions are disrupted. And we realize that they are always incomplete. Whatever we have gathered in the realm of knowledge is always lacking. We realize that there's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to keep. No matter what we do with our life. Some people have great lives, like leave a huge stamp. Shakyamuni Buddha left a huge mark, right? I read that, you know, I used to like to read about, you know, like old history, Greek history and Roman history and those kind of things. I read a biography of Alexander the Great, who I think died at 34 after conquering most of the world, right? He left a big mark and big, like, bruise, actually, probably for a lot of people. And it said that when he, at one point he was riding into, you know, to go and roll over the next country, and crossing into India, they came across a spiritual practitioner, not unlike the Buddha. So he just had a loincloth on. And it said, as we rode past him, he looked up at Alexander the Great and said, "Mighty as you are, you'll never own even the ground under your feet." And In the second, it took, you know, Alexander the Great to stop him, somebody running him through with a lance, right? He said, halt. And he said, let's bring him with us. And he was with him for the rest of how long he lived. Because he was he wasn't in that position by accident. He recognized wisdom, he recognized truth in that. You won't even own the ground beneath your feet. We have this life, there's no ownership or possession in this. In one sense, we're just passing through. Coming in with nothing and going out with nothing. And the whole way through. So then what to do with the time? What to do with this happening? Who do we do it for? Why is it done? You know, in the koan, even Shakyamuni and Maitreya are servants of that one. This business of Zen, or this business of Sashin, really comes down to the examination of who is that one. You say that one, you can say provisionally if it's not really seen, that one. And as it's realized, it becomes this one. Who is this one? It says servants of that one. You know, this servant can be a tricky word, because you know, perhaps it has somewhat of a negative connotation. To be a servant. It reminds me of, you know, when I was a kid, I remember my parents watching there's an old British show called Upstairs Downstairs. Had all the toffs, all the posh people upstairs, and now, well, we got Downton Abbey now. It's something like that, you know. You got your elevated people and those below who are serving them, and that can be the connotation of servant, you know, somebody who's serving somebody else. Well, that doesn't sound great. Is that what I'm supposed to do? Just look after, you know, work and serve people stuff. But if we look at the meaning, you go to the root, the etymology of the word, you know, serve and serve or vant in old French, it means serving person. There's no other in it. It's not about serving someone else. Person serving. Person serving. You know, fulfilling the function of taking care of this experience. How do we apply that? We wish to serve, to take care of this experience. If we apply that, even Shakyamuni, we encourage by these great examples, people with, like, you know, even one of them is, I think, mythic in this case, right? But given great, endowed with great capacities. It may start out in one sense of, like, a sense of naturally doing this for me. I'm doing this for me. There's nothing wrong with that. There's that motivation to clarify, but it leads us to the question of what is that? Who is that one? Who is this me? With these long periods of Zazen and the opportunity for Dokusan and the teachings, and what we glean from the experience, this sense of me as the identified, separate, you know, described, defined, conditioned one that is shaken up, begins to shift. And you see that this collection of experiences does not reach the bottom. It only lives in this, it lives in this experience as a story of our life. Nothing wrong with that, but there's no fixed existent truth there that we can really pull out or come up with. You're a different person now than the person we were when we walked in before this period of Zazen began. Biologically, physically, emotionally, different. So we aggregate so much to this sense of me. And if we sit and then we toy with that, you know, either add, you know, adding or subtracting to the description of me, then that is still, that's moving the chairs around, deck chairs around on the Titanic. Right, which is slowly sinking, irrevocably. It may take a long time to go down, and I hope the water's warm, but it's sinking. So it's not a good investment to just consistently try and prop that one up. Much better to let that one, the me sense, that one, let that be disrupted with this practice of Zazen, this practice of, very broad, like oneness doing, not just on the cushion, but in the action of whatever the present experience is. You know, no need to continue to construct in that way. It's a wonderful part of the schedule, upholding of the schedule. At this point, you know what's next. Don't have to do a lot of thinking or planning about it. Just move seamlessly into the next activity so that we see that this is just one great activity from Shakyamuni to Maitreya. That is just the function of this. How do we align with this? If we're stuck in like how I'm doing in this or what this is doing for me or where I am with it, we're always got one foot outside it, looking in with preference and commenting on. Much better to just disappear as that, being who we are, each one of us. Often we doubt that we put Shakyamuni on this high and Maitreya maybe this high and other people, and we have our ranking. Maybe we do it in here. Well, these people know this, that's why they're doing that, and etc. We put ourselves in a certain place, either a high place or a low place. Better to let that go. That's always just extra. That's just a description. I was talking to my friend Veron, who went down to see just before session. He was telling me he was at the temple where he is in Japan with Shogenji, with his teacher. And they went into the Founders Hall, which is over here, is right back there behind the altar, into the Kaisando. And he said at the temple there, you have to kind of go down some steps, and you can't really see, you have to go low, and you can't really see what's up there, right? Which says something right there, right? So you have to go down. So he goes in there with Abbot Varoshi, and they're doing the offerings to, it's Kanzen Egan, so founder of the Miyasenji Rinzai School, represented there, and others. And he said he's doing these things, and there's one point where he hits a bell, and he hits the clappers, and he hit the clappers, and he hit the clappers a little loud. And he said his teacher scolded him. It's like, what are you doing? Hit them like that. How do you have such confidence in front of you, in here? You know, basically. And you kind of paraphrase it. You know, and that really struck me. It struck him. You know, in that situation. And it's not about, you should hit them like, you know, lightly, like, oh, I'm not worthy. That's the other end, the other side of the spectrum. These people are amazing. Shakyamuni, Maitreya, and this master, and everything. Oh, I'm crap, you know. I'm going to hit the clappers like this. No. It's not like hitting them like, I know what's going on. I've reached this kind of enlightenment or insight. I'm going to give them a good... No. You know, when we strike these bells... I'll strike these clappers. I'm putting a lot of pressure on Daniel. You know, you invite the clappers to be struck. You make the space and invite the bell to ring. And take out the me out of that. It doesn't need to have so much me in it. And that goes right through all of these activities. There's enough me already, rather than having to add more. But whatever needs to be done, taking care of that one thing as it is taken care of. Often we struggle again. Well, why do we do it like this? Or why do I do it like that? Maybe I should do it this way. Maybe I should do it that way. There's so much to be learned or understood in just doing this as it appears. And we can bring that to all of our activities. Very important in Zazen. We have our instructions for practice from the beginning. It should be pretty clear at this point what we're doing on the cushion. Is that being done? And it's natural that we have a certain process to go through. A certain process. And we tussle, and there's a difficulty that's inherent. That's why we do so much of it. Do so much sitting. That's why it's 7 days, not one day. It tends to take a while. We need to have our noses rubbed in reality. That's how stubborn we are. You have to have our noses rubbed in it. Because we're so wily and expert at avoiding that, avoiding our responsibility, ultimately, to, as it says here, a servant of that one. And he asks, tell me, who is that one? It brings us to that question of what is the self. We shouldn't just skip straight over that, you know, but really that is the business again of session or is practice, taking a really close, the practice of intimacy with this self, to look, how is self and other organized in our mind? Are there people who are not in the club? In this koan, it starts with Shakyamuni, goes all the way to Maitreya, and that's a circle. Not from A to B, but in this great circle. If it's not in everyone and all things together, then it's not real. It's not the real thing. There's still people on the outs. But we navigate this world with the appearance of other. Of the apparent appearance of others. There's a lot of different looking people in this room. You know, relatively, there's a lot of difference. So, but what is it there that is not separate? What is the true nature of this self? Where are the gaps? Where are the joins? You know, when you do that in our mind and we put others on the outside, what is that? Are they on the outside? What do we really know? You know, in the verse, don't draw another's bow. Don't ride another's horse. Don't speak of another's faults. Don't try to know about another's affairs. Another. It's the same character. We talked about translation earlier in the week, but how subtle these translations can be. You know, here the translation of the character is another's affairs or another's property. Same character as that one. But Yamada Roshi, when he translated this, felt it important not to use another as the translation for the koan. Not to say as servants of another. Because right there, it leads us into this, like, what is that split? We say another, you just put it out there. You say that one, it's like, who's that? Turns us right back at this, to really look. sometimes we'll kind of rank our practice or how we're doing or how our zazen is or how my session's going. You know, and you might be having the experience, well, I'm having a horrible time. And if so, well, thank you for being here. You know, thank you for being here and having the courage to continue to go through that, because whatever is going on in this one here, in this lens, whether it's good or bad, it's holding everybody else. You could come here and have the worst session compared to what, you know, having a terrible time, but you thank you for supporting me and the people next to you and the person across the room. You know, it serves. It serves to have everyone come together, to allow the container, you know, to form, you know, to really to create or help create this place where you can really look, where the transformation can really occur, where old patterns and descriptions and ways which have kept us bound, that those knots can be loosened, and we find the freedom which all of these cases and this great tradition talks of. And you taste it and you know it. You know, in Mumon's commentary, he says, if you clearly recognize that one, it's just like meeting your father at the crossroads. It's not necessary to ask whether it's him or not. You know, or in another place, we have the Zen saying, when you drink water, you know for yourself whether it is cool or warm. Zazen is practice is that way. Realization is that way. You know, we can hear all the descriptions in the world and all the explanations, and it doesn't really do much for us. But when you really understand, when you look at the nature of this self, what you realize then, it cannot be disputed. You realize you know it. You know yourself. You know truth recognizes truth. It's a nice analogy, you know, some glimpse I was reading about how they have these trying to get autonomous cars going, and realizing that it's maybe a bit more difficult than, you know, the timeline's a bit longer to get this done. It's just apparently the way that we're able to organize this information flow as these smart human beings that we are, it's incredibly subtle. You know, you can glimpse somebody driving past in a car and in a millisecond, if it's a relative or somebody that you know, and you just see the ear or the back of the head and you know it's them. And anything programmed is just a million miles from that kind of detection. You know. It's like you see an old photograph and recognize a relative, or you spot that. You can have real trust in this practice of this inquiry, that it has worked. It would not have been maintained to this day. Right? We can avail ourselves of this vehicle in order to rediscover or find our intrinsic freedom and peace. And when we find that, you know it. It's not something you have to remember. It's not a piece of information to remember in the mind. And although we don't own the ground under our feet, we're satisfied and at home on that patch of ground. And we don't have to compare it as good, bad, or better than another place. The trust of a life is in this patch of ground. Whatever that experience, however that is showing up. It's a good thing about sitting so much is that you sit when you don't want to. I was talking to a friend who's a teacher in a different tradition, and he was telling me, I love meditation. And I'm like, really? And he goes, yeah, why, don't you? And I'm like, not really. I mean, for most of my meditation career, it seemed an expedient vehicle for awakening. It's like much of the time, it's just like grinding through glass or something, you know? Like long sessions in pain and the difficulty of the practice. I don't love it much of the time. But that's not a bad thing. We're just not here to like fall in love with sitting in stillness. Right? But rather through sitting in stillness, we find our home regardless of the circumstances of good or bad. So that when it's difficult, it's difficult. Boring, it's boring. Confusing, it's confusing. And, you know, and so on and so forth. But that is no longer shaking us from our seat so that we fall into doubt and comparison with other. But you know the one you are. That one. And, you know, it's like as I brought up at the beginning, we live in this age where all of the world's problems are like flashing up on the screen. And we could see, you know, we've become aware of these like global issues and national issues and what are we going to do about this and that? You know, but let's not overlook taking care of this, whatever this is. Not meaning that we can't become involved in those things. In you know, wider activities. But our living experience is always in whatever is right now, whatever is at hand. And if we really find ourselves here, then you see that there's a lot to take care of in every direction. You find the function of this moment now, what's required. Not in a martyrdom sense of like, I've got to clean the whole world up, but like it's whatever your life, whatever my life is, whatever your life is, what is the business of your life? Taking care and matching that. But with the trust that we're in always the right place, the right time, the right ingredients. So, you know, as we're advancing through the days, whatever that means, but we have had this time of settling and gone through a lot of the difficulty of the physicality of sitting and keeping ourselves, you know, developing that focus, and now is the time to really to deepen. It's a time we don't slack off at the end, but rather it's like a doubling down. You know, it's like leave everything on the field in session. Leave everything on the field. Yeah. But we don't have to take it on as a big, difficult, how do I work this out project. You only have to take care of whatever is at hand now. What is this? Who is that one? How do I take care of this? And thank you for your strong efforts so far. And we'll finish.